Hello, welcome back to What Do You Do? In this series, I chat to people who work in music, all about what they do and how they got there. In this week's episode, I'm chatting to Jessica Sharman. Jessica is a songwriter, producer, and just a lovely person, and I really enjoyed chatting with her and hearing about how she got started in songwriting. In this chat, we speak a little bit about how Jessica got started in the music industry, the day-to-day realities of being a songwriter, and some of Jessica's tips and tricks for the mindset that you need to have as a creative in the industry. I hope you enjoy our chat, and if you do, please like, rate, and subscribe. So welcome, Jessica Sharman. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
On What Do You Do? We are going to be exploring a little bit about your career and how you've got there. So the question we like to begin with is, what do you do?
So I am a songwriter and producer, and I write for and with artists and producers and other writers for songs.
Amazing. I'm so happy to have you on the podcast because so far we've spoken with a lot of people who work on the industry side of things.
Okay.
So agents and publishers and sync reps. So it's great to talk to someone who is working on the more creative side.
Mm-hmm.
So taking us back, did you always know that you wanted to be a songwriter and producer?
I didn't know that a songwriter as it kind of exists, as my career now existed.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved music. I loved playing. I loved singing. I really enjoyed writing poetry. And then when I began to combine the two, I felt very proud of myself, aged eight.
Oh, wow.
But it was absolutely probably one of the worst songs I've ever written and will never see the light of day. But it was realizing this kind of creative spark was there, and it was something that I could do myself, but I had no idea that it could be sort of a job. I didn't know that people would want to pay me to write songs, to produce up their songs or songs that we'd written together. And it was only when I was about 12 and I'd got one of those kind of Casio keyboards, and you could sort of press one of the buttons and it would have a drum loop, and then you could sort of play over the drum loop, and then I was singing and playing over the drum loop, and my mum was like, well, you know, this is quite good, I wonder if there's, and she said, can you keep it, like, can I play it to my grandma or something?
Oh.
And I said, I have no idea. So we began to kind of go to music shops, and there was a piece of software called Cubase, and so I got that for my birthday, my 13th birthday, and I started kind of using that and going, oh, this is really cool. And I think that's where the kind of production
side came in.
Side, yeah.
12 is very young.
It is quite
so
young.
So did you know at 12, I want to be a songwriter? Or did you ever consider another career in your teens and when you were at school?
I think it was always going to be some sort of music. I think, again, still, I didn't know that I was producing.
Mm.
I just was kind of creating. I was just making music. And really enjoyed it. And it wasn't till, I remember this quite vividly, I was about 14 and I heard a song on the radio, and it was just my day. It described my day as a 14-year-old teenager at school, and it was called Misfit by Amy Stutt. And I just remember thinking, oh my gosh, she has climbed into
She's
my brain.
Speaking to me.
And literally put onto a 3-minute song everything I felt. And I started thinking, I said, that is the coolest thing in the world, that I don't feel alone and that this song has made other people not feel alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that's what I want to do. That's
yeah.
what I want to do. I want to make people feel like they're not the only ones who feel a certain
that's
way.
Lovely. That's so pure.
And but it was, I remembered it really vividly. It was a very kind of, you know, light bulb moment. And it was then that I really, like, my songwriting changed to be less about maybe what I was thinking and more about what could be, what everyone could feel and what everyone could kind
relate
of
to.
Connect with, yeah, and relate to and be a part of. But again, it still wasn't this understanding that songwriting was a career or that producing was a career. The only thing I really knew of was that performers.
Yeah, did you want to be an artist?
So I think, what did I want to be? I think the ideal was, if I had been good enough, it would have been lovely. But I kind of knew I didn't have a voice that kind of stopped people in the street. And
I can't, I'm sure you have a beautiful voice. I've never heard you sing. So I feel like you're probably underselling yourself.
Well,
but
you're very kind. My sister was an amazing singer and she was the kind of the one that sung in the house. So I played piano and guitar and she was the singer. And I remember on car journeys when we were younger, if like she would sing songs in the car and if I ever wanted to join in, I'd have to do harmonies.
Okay.
So, which was actually amazing. It was such incredible grounding for me to then be able to kind of jump into a session now and be like, oh, that's what the harmony is, or that's what we can do, and do loads of vocal arranging. So I've obviously got my sister to thank for that. But so it was always a backing thing. It was always a, it was never like a main voice. And I think it was, just not lead. Mm-hmm. And I didn't love it. I got really scared. I got very kind of sweaty palms and I'd always get super ill before any time I gigged.
Performance anxiety.
Yeah, I think I sort of felt like I was a bit of a fraud because I knew I wasn't insane, but I knew I just loved music. Mm-hmm. And thought that was my only way, so I worked really hard and I tried to overcome my anxieties of performing. There was one time, and I went to university, so my parents are both therapists, and when I sort of at 16 was like, right, I want to go to performing arts school.
A lot of sense that your parents are therapists, because I know what you do in sessions, because all of the artists I work with told me how much you are basically like a therapist. This makes a lot of sense.
Yes, it all trickles down. Shaman therapy. But they were very nervous. They'd seen a lot of kind of artists in the industry and even industry professionals, and like how dog eat dog it was and how tough it was. So they were sort of saying, what you need to do is kind of keep yourself interested and keep being interesting to other people. So mm-hmm. they really recommended me going to university. And at the time I was very sort of rebellious and upset about it, but it was one of the best things because I went and did a degree in history of art and absolutely loved it.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And it helped so much with my lyric writing, because the whole point of history of art is showing someone a story, and from those kind of visual images you understand something. And that's really what really great songwriting is. You show your listener, you show them what the character's wearing, what they're doing, what the situation is, kind of using a lot of visual metaphors. But when I was there, I was gigging maybe 3 times a week, just pub gigs and kind of any sort of local university talent shows. Mm-hmm. I was just sort of entering. I was you know, doing quite well on that sort of very, very small scene. And one time I had this really big gig. I organised it with a pub and they'd given me the top room and it was this really lush place, and I completely lost my voice.
Oh,
completely lost my voice. And I was thinking, I'm never going to be able to do this. And then one of my friends was like, listen, I can, you know, if you can muster some of it, I know all your songs, I'll help you sing them. And
interesting.
They were singing
your songs,
my songs, and I was thinking, and even kind of on stage when I was playing, because I was, what was so frustrating is I was well but just couldn't sing. And it was so interesting to hear how they interpreted it, what, you know, kind of melody flicks and different things that they did. And I was thinking, like, this is really cool. And it sort of took maybe a year or so to kind of settle in as like a proper idea. And I went traveling after university and took, you know, bought a guitar at the first place we landed and was playing a bunch of songs, and people were going, oh my gosh, is this what you do for a living? And I said, oh, no.
I don't have a living.
I'm still very young. Not that young. 22. Should have been working harder. But it was taking outside people to sort of really kind of steer me in the direction mm-hmm. that I didn't really kind of know existed.
Yeah. Well, I think it takes a lot of confidence to say at 16 or within your teens, I want to be a songwriter, because it's such an impossible world to break into, and to get those opportunities are so rare and so difficult. So I think there's very few people that probably decide that at an early age and actually make it happen.
Really. And I think that's right. And also really understand what it is, because I was under the impression when I was 16, listening to my favourite bands and, you know, listening to songs, I thought they wrote them. So
they don't write their own songs. Stop it.
Hate to break it to your listeners. No, it and then when I started to get into songwriting as a profession, I was going back over my favorite songs and going, oh no, I so thought they wrote that. But it kind of changed it for me, and it didn't matter, because it wasn't about you know, who wrote it or kind of what that was. It was what connected with me at the time, and the artist was the person that was the vehicle to really deliver that. So I began to sort of feel better about it when I found out my favourite artists weren't cutting or writing.
Sometimes they co-write, but
yes, exactly.
There's a lot of instances where they have not even written one word. Moving on, so I would love to know, do you remember your first cut and what was that?
Yes, I do. It was with a writer that I was working, or she's a singer-songwriter called Kerry Watt, Scottish singer-songwriter.
I know Kerry. Yes. Yeah.
And she'd moved down from Scotland to London. I think it was maybe our second session we wrote this song called Who's Loving Me Now? And she, you know, we had a really great time. She's kind of a really great girl to get on with. And it was really fun writing with her. And then about 2 months later, she's like, I'm going to make it my single. I've just signed like a distribution deal. I'm going to put it out. And it was like, oh my gosh, that's amazing.
So exciting.
So that came out and got on Radio 2. And it was this, you know, kind of really cool moment. I made sure I was sitting in a car because I always really wanted to hear one of my songs on the radio.
Aww.
And because like no one has radios anymore and everyone listens online, I was like, find a car and listen to Radio 2. But it was incredible. And it was just really exciting. And it was like, oh, this is...
This is real.
This is real. And I think it also proved it to a lot of people sort of around me being like, what is actually happening? What is it that you do? Because especially for a songwriter, like a singer can write a song, go out and perform it, and someone can see what they've done with their day.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with a songwriter, process from writing to recording to release can take, you know, with some of my most recent stuff with Ward Thomas, that's been, we wrote three of the tracks on the new record in 2015.
Wow.
And it's just they've only just come out. They've only just come out because they've used different songs, they've merged, they've grown, they've done different things.
Yeah.
And so it can take quite a long time. So to have that sort of physical thing of on the radio and someone going, oh, you actually, this is a thing, was really exciting.
Do you think about that when you're in the room with people? Do you think this sounds like it could be on the radio, or this sounds like it's going to make the album? Or do you try and just write what comes out and be in the moment?
I think I used to, when I was sort of doing a lot of top lines and a lot more kind of dance pop stuff, I would think what would happen next on the radio, and it kind of turned into quite formulaic writing for me.
Yeah.
And I then found I wasn't being honest because I was just trying to write what I thought people would want to hear or what I thought the radio would play.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of songs that I've written that I think, oh, that definitely should have been on the radio, but it just hasn't quite, you know, got there yet. But as a process, I just try and write in the room at the time for the artist. And you do get, there is a moment where you kind of get a sense, like really deep in your gut going, this is a killer song. I don't know why, I don't know how, but it just is, and this is going to do something.
Yeah.
And most of the time that's kind of come true and followed through.
So taking us back, you've had one cut with Kerry.
Mm-hmm.
When did you begin to embrace the songwriter life, and you know, did you know how to produce at this time, or when did you learn to produce, and when was songwriting always your full-time job at this time?
So no, not when I started out, it wasn't full-time. It was sort of quite a patchwork career.
Yeah.
In that I would save all of my days. I made sure that any kind of jobs that I did to like help pay rent and cover costs would be in and around a time between 10 and 4. So I would always have 10 and 4 to write songs and have artists come over or work on production. And I was producing, I'd learned Logic. So I moved on from Cubasis and learned Logic I did a year's professional diploma at the ICMP in North London. And they taught us kind of production skills and how to grow a song and kind of what those things were. So, you know, I'd either do remote kind of freelance admin in the mornings. I'd be getting up at 7 and kind of be doing admin work. Then from 10 until 4, I'd be writing songs. And then I'd either go, I'd work in a pub, or I was a teacher. So I did some teaching stuff. A couple of times, you know, I had a piano bar job. It was just loads and loads of different things.
Because it's not an easy career to make money from initially. It takes long time to build up.
It does take time.
Reputation.
Yeah. And you know, kind of also earn your stripes. Mm-hmm. I think it was the song with Kerry was amazing, but it was like, that's just one, and you need sort of 20 more of those to kind of really keep yourself or like show the industry that you've arrived.
Can we talk about that? Can we talk about how do you get paid? How does a songwriter get paid from a song?
So from a single song, you can get paid from many different directions. You can get paid via the radio, mm-hmm. Which is through PRS. PRS is a performance rights society, and that is the most important kind of income for an artist. And they will cover things like radio, like if you do live tours, they will take a section of that. If your song is played in restaurants or pubs, you should see little stickers saying PRS for music, and if you don't, then you should go and tell them.
report them.
So they kind of, you register your songs with them, it has a unique code, and then they will track that code every time, and then they will pay you your royalties from that.
And how often do they pay you? Because it's sadly not monthly. I know that.
4 times a year. Which is really tough. Yeah. And I'm keeping quite a close eye on like a lot of what Imogen Heap's doing with some of her kind of amazing music tech work, which
it's
is
incredible. I mean,
really, really incredible.
Speak about that on a podcast for hours.
I heart Imogen Heap. But what she's kind of trying to do and trying to change, and it's a really crazy thing. You sort of say, you'd never say to a lawyer, oh, okay, cool, well, I'll pay you for that contract in September, you know, from January. They just would look at you like you just said you were going to walk on the moon. Yeah, with songwriting and even production, like, again, I'm getting to understand the grips of how PPL do it, because I've just been so used to PRS. With my production work being more present in the past year, I'm beginning to kind of understand how that all happens. But yeah, the main source is PRS. And then, you know, it's very rare that you get paid to do a session.
But you could get paid a production fee, possibly?
Not definitely, but most of the time you get paid a production fee for kind of work you've done, or some people will pay you part for the demo and then pay you on top for the finished product, or just pay you for the finished product. Production is much, because sometimes if it isn't your song, you don't have an investment in it.
It's so interesting because your time is so speculative. So you could do a week of sessions, mm-hmm. 5 days a week with 5 different artists, and you have no promise of being paid.
No.
And you could sit in a room and pour your heart out with someone, mm-hmm. and work on a track for hours. And then maybe 7 months down the line, they say, oh, I'm not using that song.
Or one thing that happened to me very early on in my career was a really wonderful artist that I worked with just got broken down by just how tough it is as an industry. And, you know, this promise of like a label kind of financial backer that was supporting him. And I worked with him sort of to maybe he'd been doing it for about 4 years. And I came in sort of on the third year, and we were writing amazing songs, producing them up, like, sounding incredible. And then he gave me a call one day and was like, I can't do it anymore. I just can't do it anymore. I'm out. I have to go. And he's now doing something in marketing, and it's just so.
Wow.
But I remember thinking, like,
you can't,
oh my
do this.
Gosh.
These songs are too good.
And also just like his belief in himself had just kind of totally disintegrated, whereas I just believed in him so much. And kind of what we were doing. What it did make me realise was you cannot rely on one person. You can't put all your eggs in one basket. You can't, as a songwriter, go, I'm only going to write with this artist, or this person is going to take me to my next level.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky early on in my career. I spoke with Sasha Scarbeck, which was amazing.
Wow.
And he's just the loveliest, loveliest human being. But he was talking to me saying, don't try and chase what's already come out, you know, whoever's like big right now, don't chase them. Find
the next big thing.
Yeah. Find the underground people, go to underground gigs. You know, he said James Blunt wasn't anyone when I was writing You're Beautiful with him, and you know, he's
probably bought a house off
probably
that song. Yeah.
Maybe several. But I think that kind of, you do it because you love it, and it still astounds people today that, you know, how many different people I work with, there's kind of no payment and there's nothing to do with it. But I feel now, kind of where I've sort of grown into my career, I can be a bit more picky, mm-hmm. and sort of say, okay, I want to do a session with this person because I believe in their voice, or I really like their writing sensibility and I can kind of give myself a bit more. Whereas before I was just spreading myself so thinly, doing like 7 sessions a week and every day just hoping that every person would be the right person, even if I didn't like their stuff and I was writing things that I didn't necessarily believe in, it was just kind of do whatever you can to get out there. And I do think that was probably like a 10,000 hours of practice thing, just kind of working in different situations and going, okay, does this work? No, does this work? No. And it sort of helped me realize what I did and didn't want to do.
That's so valuable. And that's something, doing that kind of hard work now, you know, and you have the luxury of being able to not do every session.
Yeah.
But that's interesting that you had to kind of, it's almost like a songwriting internship.
It sort of was. Yeah, it really was.
So who puts sessions in your diary and how do they become arranged? And what advice would you give for people who are trying to get in a room with an artist and become a songwriter? How do they do that?
So I managed myself for about 5 to 6 years.
Wow.
Yeah,
I did it
all myself. And it was only last year that I signed with Jack's management, who have been amazing, and they now set up my diary, but they still kind of keep in touch with me saying, listen, we've been, you know, this label's got in contact, what do you think, do you like this artist? They're very, it's very kind of collaborative. But for the early part of my career, it was just me.
Wow.
And
how did you get in the room with
artists? Hustled.
Oh wow.
So hard. I probably irritated pretty much every label in London and publisher, and I would just go in for meetings and I'd say, right, I've got these songs and I've got this and I'm working on this at the minute, and like it was nothing. I had air, but I was just doing an Emperor's New Clothes and trying to sort of show them. It was just about getting in the room and getting one person to go, okay, I'll give you a shot. Mm-hmm. And for every 5 that I met, 4 turned me down, but one would go, you know what, I really like that melody, let's put you in with so and so.
Yeah.
And
it's so, kind of a stepping stone game where when you get one cut, then you might get some more sessions. And then when you get a couple of cuts, more people hear about you and you get more sessions.
And it is quite word of mouthy. So I think you have to be conscious not to be irritating. I was trying to be sort of squeaky wheel persistent and it paid off. The other thing I did, which I don't think is done enough these days because you can do it so much easier on Spotify and on Instagram, but I went to so many gigs.
Oh,
and I went to open
mics.
I went to kind of shows at the Bedford. I would find all the, so if there was a big show going on, like a kind of really big name, I would go and find out who the support were and I'd go and see the support. I'd meet them at the merch table afterwards. I'd give them, you know, I had business cards, which feels quite like
old school.
But I would just kind of make connections. And it is really surprising how, if you do your homework, so I would know what their songs were and I would go up to them afterwards saying, I loved this song, or this lyric was great, I really, you know, would really like to co-write with you if you'd be keen. It is amazing how receptive people are when you really know what they've done
and
you value them and you're not just like,
I'm a songwriter, I would love to write with you, you should write with me. It's like,
exactly.
Oh, I loved this song you did, I think I could
bring something, you know, to the mix. And also that I'd notice things that they might have really felt strongly about. Mm-hmm. And similarly, like today, if someone wants to do a session with me and, you know, they say, oh, I really love this song that you did with this so-and-so and this, that's going to make me much more receptive because I go, oh, you've done your homework.
They haven't just sent a blanket email trying to, get in a session.
Yeah.
So how do you split your time now? And are you still going to gigs and trying to find new artists, or only working with artists who have record labels or record deals or management? Or how do you decide who to work with and who to write songs with?
It's a real balancing act. I still occasionally go to gigs, but I do it less than I did when I was starting out and really trying to hustle. I have had long chats with my management about this and saying, you know, there are some times where I'll hear something and I'll think, oh my gosh, that song is absolute killer, look up the person, they're unsigned, unmanaged, but there's something there and I want to be a part of that, so I'll put myself out on a limb.
Yeah.
But it tends to be people with labels or management, but I would never sort of say exclusively that I only write with those people, because you never know who's going to be the next someone. And, you know, for people, if, for example, like the Ward Thomas sisters, I was working with them in since 2013 or 2014. No one knew who they were. No, and I kept saying, oh, they're these really great, you know,
country
twin artists. Sisters. They're really fab. And everyone was like, who?
Country music probably wasn't on vogue at the time.
No, it wasn't. And it's now, you know, now a very different story. But it was, you know, astonishing for me. I've been working with this guy called Belmont since 2012. And he's just signed a massive deal in the States with Warner. Like, but I've been saying for ages, and you have to put those time in.
So you have to follow your gut also with who you are a fan of.
Exactly.
Yeah. Amazing. And so, okay, let's talk about Ward Thomas. Mm-hmm. You have had now a UK number one album. Mm-hmm. Surely that opens every door to you, or does it? And also, can you tell us a little bit about how that felt to have a number one album?
It was bonkers. It was really crazy. It was so unexpected. Everyone was sort of like, maybe top 40, that would be so great. Started to kind of, you know,
build and build.
And then it was this sort of very, very surreal moment going, wait, what?
We have a chance at this. Like, it was kind of a storm in a teacup, I feel, with them, because they are very popular and they have an incredible fan base.
Yeah.
But also at the exact same time, country music was having this massive renaissance in the UK. And I think they came at the exact right time. And obviously they're hugely talented, but there was an element of
right time, right place.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they'd put the hours in for sure, but it just happened to be at that moment, everything just kind of worked with their favour. Yeah, we were at their house, and we, you know, found out from the official charts thing, and it was amazing. And it was really when kind of the golden statue came that you're just like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. It did open a lot of doors. It, you know, I signed a publishing deal off the back of it.
Incredible.
Which was, you know, great. And I definitely had quite a large cut to sort of go in and say, well, I've had five tracks on the number one Ward Thomas album. But it was harder than I thought, because country still hadn't really... I had a lot of people saying, well, if it was five tracks on a pop record, it would be a very different story.
It doesn't have the same place in the media, I
exactly.
guess.
Yeah, and it's bizarre, because, you know, at the end of the day, a song is a song and people have bought it for a reason. I write in so many different genres. Country was just the genre that happened to kind of go for me at the time, but I've done a lot of electronic stuff, I've done a lot of pop stuff, I've done a lot of dance and kind of soul. So it was also then having to like re-persuade the industry that I wasn't just a country girl.
Yeah.
And that it was something else.
You can do many different genres, and they shouldn't just send their country artists.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know about your family members or people that you know. Did that kind of legitimize you? Like, I'm not just, you know, making songs in my bedroom all day. I have a number one album.
My dad said, I should have listened to you. And he goes, does this mean first class now? That's what he's always said. They were absolutely shocked. And we did like a little Facebook live video when it happened. And when that went viral, one of my friends who kind of understands the industry, it's very difficult to understand what a song, like what a music person does when you've got a very, very set hours in a kind of very normal office job. But I remember her sending me the link back going, okay, now I know you've made it, because I've got this, not through you, but through loads of other things, which was really nice. And the support has been amazing. And, you know, friends and family have always just really believed in it and been there and been like, you've just got to give it a go. And I think when you know you can't do anything else, when you know, it's like, okay, I remember reading an article with Jamie Hartman, who's a songwriter from the UK, but he's living in LA now. And he said, if you think you could be an engineer or a doctor or an interior designer, like, go and do those jobs. But if you can't be anything else but a songwriter or but a producer, everything will start falling into place. And I remember reading that going, I can't think of doing anything else. And it was bizarre how it would be like, oh no, I really need this to pay the rent. And someone would be like, hey, will you do a cover gig with me? I'll give you 200 quid. And you're like, oh, brilliant. Okay, cool. That's covered that. So it's weird how it, you know, the kind of, when your mindset changes, everything else does kind of fall into place.
Mm-hmm. Also, the fact that once you have a UK number one album, I'm sure it doesn't end there.
No.
you probably have tons more ambitions, and even the way the music industry has changed, getting a number one album is getting more and more difficult all the time with streaming. What are the kind of things on your songwriter bucket list that you would love to do?
Oh, crikey. I don't think we've got enough time. I'd love to kind of... songwriter bucket list. I'd love to be able to not have to sort of every maybe 2 months have a panic of like, what is being released this year?
Yeah.
Or who is someone new who's coming up? What is happening here? And just kind of have a bit more of a steady belief that it's like, it will happen. But I do kind of
it's
also...
It's so difficult because it's so out of your control in a way. All you can do is write the songs, the best songs that you can at any given time.
I actually have a better answer. My songwriter bucket list is to have a different song on the radio at one time. So you could flick through all the channels and there would be a song that I've been a part of on each of those channels.
Incredible.
And I think that would kind of not only be something that would just be really cool, but would also prove to everybody that you can only be boxed if you've had success in one style.
Mm-hmm. That you are not the country girl that you hear on Radio 2. You could be the pop on Radio 1.
The pop on Radio 1.
Or the indie on 6 Music.
Exactly.
Amazing. Good answer.
Yeah. That's a better answer.
And do you have a piece of advice that you give to young songwriters or even to young artists trying to crack into the industry?
It sounds really naff, but don't have a... If you really, really want to do it and you really believe that you can do it, be kind and don't have a plan B, because the time that you spend
that's a controversial one.
Yeah, because I think it's a very important one, because the time you spend focusing on setting up your plan B means that you have no time for your plan A. And that's why lots of people end up going into plan B, because that's where their focus is. If you're always focusing on plan A and you're going, okay, how can I get little bits and bobs around me to keep pushing that up? Every kind of extra little part-time job that I was doing was involved in and around music. If it would be, as I said, playing in a piano bar or teaching music or doing cover gigs, that was helping with my music, because I was
very brave
learning songs. I was, you know, involved in music conversations when things were happening. And I think having that belief and not being like, kind of filter out the noise. People will be negative a lot of the time and say like, oh, but creatives don't work. There's one story that happened to me. Maybe I think after I'd left music school and was sort of doing the kind of music scene and doing top lining and in with, you know, different pop producers every day, I was really struggling with sort of saying I was a songwriter. If you go to a party and someone say, what do you do? And, you know, actually having the bravery to go, I'm a songwriter, because you know the next question is going to be,
oh,
anything I would have heard?
Yeah.
And which is just like the worst question that anybody can ask. Because when you're starting out, you're like, well, no, but I've got some hits that are going to happen. And I went to this party once in town and was there with a friend, and this guy was saying, you know, what do you do? And I was like, okay, I'm going to be brave and I'm going to say it. And I was like, I'm a songwriter. And like, before I could blink or breathe, or before he asked who I'd written for or with, he was like, well, what's your plan B? And in front of all these people, and it just totally broke me. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, this is the worst moment ever. And then this wonderful human, don't know who they were, but they turned to him and they said, sorry, what do you do? He said, oh, I'm in finance. And they were like, well, financial markets look a bit dodgy at the minute. What's your plan B?
What's your bloody plan B, mate?
And it shifted my whole mindset, because I thought, yeah, actually, no one's job is like secure. You can go and work in a supermarket and they make redundancies. You can go and work as a, you know,
Absolutely.
Solicitor, and something happens in the company and it all gets reshuffled and moved. Like, there's no security. So if you can keep your head above water and you're happy with what you're doing, don't go for plan B, stick with plan A.
That's incredible advice, that it is just as fickle as any other job.
As anything else, yeah.
All right, well, I think that's a great note to leave the podcast on. Thank you so much, Jess,
for
speaking to us. And we will leave the names of all of the artists and songs that you mentioned and some links to your work in the show notes below.
Oh, thanks.
And yeah, thank you so much.